Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I hope everybody could hear me. I'm waiting for author Rick Acker to call in, and he hasn't called in yet. So I hope that you can hear me. I hope anybody could hear me. The title of the book is Guilty Blood, and I'm waiting for the author to call in. I don't know what's happening that he's not able to call in yet. But the episode is live, and it went live a little too fast. And it should be. Yeah, now it's on. And I'm waiting for author Rick Acker to call in, and he hasn't called in yet. And the title of the book is Guilty Blood, and the is Jessica Ames is desperate. Her college-age son, Brandon, has been arrested, and we're waiting to find out what happens next. I have no idea what's going on, and I don't know why he hasn't called in yet. The show is live, and I don't know why I'm having a problem here. This is so weird. I'm going to call in on my cell phone and see if there's a problem if I do that. And the title of the book, like I said, is Guilty Blood. And I'm waiting for author. He is the Deputy Supervising Attorney General of California. And I have no idea why he's having trouble calling in to the show. I'm going to call in on my cell phone and see if I have a problem getting through. I'm not having trouble at all. This is weird. The host is there. That's just it. Something's wrong with this connection. Shit.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. There's something wrong with this stupid connection. I don't know. And I'm having trouble signing in myself. But you can hear me now?
Yes, now I can hear you.
I don't know what's happening. It's like so weird. I called in four times. And I'm saying I know that you called in. I just hope I don't get disconnected. I'm just leaving it the way it is. Okay. Yay. This is Rick Acker. And I don't know. I couldn't hear anything. And I'm saying I know you called in. And this stupid blog talk is crazy here. Okay. So Rick is the Supervising Deputy Attorney General in California Department of Justice. This is so cool. And his book is called Guilty Blood, and this is one of my favorite books because, well, can this really happen? Can somebody really switch DNA? Jessica Ames is desperate. Her college son, Brandon, has been arrested for murder, and the evidence stacked up. This is so cool. His DNA matches the blood and skin found under the victim's nails, but yet we don't think he did it. So what kind of research did you have to do this book?
I had to do some of it. I just knew personally based on my job, but I did do a fair amount of research into DNA evidence and discovered that there are a surprising number of what are called spurious matches, where the DNA of two people can match, quote unquote match, even though they're not related, they're not twins, they may not even be the same race. And the reason for that is that the way that law enforcement matches DNA is they don't just like match up the two entire DNA molecules and then match them up, sequence by sequence. What they do is they pick a certain number of points on the molecules and see if those points happen to match. And the odds against a random match, if you get to a high enough number of points, is pretty small. Any one point can match, like on average, 7 or 8%. 7 or 8% of the time, it's going to match across one. But if you have 10 or 11 or more, the odds go down. But they don't get to zero. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But this is like so mind-boggling. So they did the DNA. I mean, everybody has their own DNA, their own composition. So this plays right into the start of the novel. And you, based on your real life job, that's exciting that you're able to do this. So why did Tell us about Ling Thomas, the man he was accused of killing, and the link to trafficking ring called Lan Long. You know, of the last five books I've read, and the one I'm reading today by Mark Cameron and Tom Clancy, that seems to be the topic of the day. How come?
Well, there is a there's a lot of interest in the news in international gangs, international trafficking, and also in a lot of countries, those organizations can be very closely tied to the governments, which makes them potentially a lot more powerful and a lot more dangerous. So that's very intriguing to a lot of people and ominous, and frankly, a little unnerving to me, too, when I was doing the research.
Yeah, I can imagine every single book that I've read so far. And I know the Tom Clancy book, A Power Empire, deals with China and something with Chinese government and drug trafficking, human trafficking. It's like, oh, my God. And I just finished Silent Games by Alex Gray, and that one was really graphic about that. So who is this Ling Thomas, and why would anybody think that Brandon would kill him?
Well, he is, as you note, he is involved in human trafficking. He is also not a very pleasant person. And, you know, he's a kind of, you know, in the area where he's killed, it's a real life area down by the docks in Oakland. It's kind of a rough area, you know, and people do wind up getting killed there from time to time. So, you know, that's the premise of the book, is that it opens with this guy who's been found dead outside a bar down there, which is unfortunately not that uncommon. And he has DNA under his fingernails that happens to match Brandon Ames, who you mentioned. And so, you know, the police, understandably, do the DNA match. Boom, they find it in the FBI's database, and they pick up Brandon Ames.
That is so amazing, because he's a college student. That wouldn't hurt anybody. But what I liked about him is that he doesn't back down either. He's my kind of person.
Well, you know, in a tough situation like that, it's would make sense. I mean, we wind this up with this in a lot in the criminal justice system. A lot of people do back down, so it does take a lot of guts to not back down when, you know, you're presented with DNA evidence. You can get put away for a very long time, and you're offered a plea deal.
I know. I've read a book about a man. His name is Philip Yar. And he was in jail, and the person that's working with him, the counsel working with him, told me all about it. And a lot of times they just say, you know, if you take this plea deal, is it true that a judge doesn't always go along with it, that they don't have to actually go along with the plea deal if they don't want to?
That's correct. They usually do. But if they think there's something wrong with the plea deal, either it's too lenient or it's too harsh, they can do something else. The plea deal is really just a suggestion by the prosecution that the defense is agreeing with.
Wow. So I'm reading the book called by James Grappandal that's not out yet, Death in Live Oak. And is it true also? I'm learning a lot. Let me tell you, I wouldn't want to even attempt to write a murder mystery, but yeah. So if somebody is accused of sending a text message, or like Brandon is accused of doing this, does the police don't have to read them his Miranda rights unless he's arrested? So they're allowed to talk to him and try to coerce him into just saying that he did it?
The police are allowed to question people who have not been arrested. That is true.
Oh God.
You get your Miranda rights get read to you when you're arrested. I mean, if you think about it, this makes sense, because otherwise, you know, let's say you have a police, an undercover officer who's interviewing a mobster, for example. If that undercover officer has to, you know, give him his Miranda rights right there, that kind of blows the whole thing, right?
So
you are under arrest that all these rights start attaching.
So we have somebody that I liked, and I don't know if you're going to bring them back again, Nate Daniels and Jessica Ames, and their past connect. Why does she want him to defend Brandon?
Well, she, like a lot of people, when her son gets arrested, and is assigned a public defender, she thinks, oh no, because she's seen the, you know, the movies with public defenders, where they're always portrayed as incompetent and overworked, et cetera. And I'll tell you that in real life, that often is not the case, at least out here. We have some very good public defender's offices. But Jessica understandably gets that impression, and she sees an early hearing where the public defender seems not to know what she's doing. And she's like, well, I have to get a decent lawyer for my son, but she doesn't have the money because criminal defense lawyers are very expensive. I mean, all good lawyers are very expensive. So she goes to a family friend who might be willing to do it.
Yeah, I know. I know from personal experience there. Everyone is very expensive. But I have to say that when I needed help for my mom when she was alive to get Medicaid and help me out, I had a legal aid public defender lawyer. And between the two of us, we got it done. So I agree with you. Some of them are really very good. I was lucky. I thought she was a novice, too. And, of course, I had another lawyer helping me and a whole bunch of people and a state senator finally at the end. But, yeah, Rachel was good. So who is Sophia, and why does she seem – this is the public defender. And she seems inept, and she's sitting at the preliminary hearing. Why doesn't she object? That was bothering me. Then when I realized why, okay, but why?
Well, here's the thing, is that criminal procedure, unless you're, like, actually involved in criminal court a lot, it's going to seem weird in a lot of places because – there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on that, again, never makes it to TV or never makes it to the movies. It's called the preliminary examination out here. And what that is the judge weighing the evidence just to see if there's enough evidence to hold the defendant for trial. So that's the prosecution has to be putting on evidence, right? Because they've got to be showing that there's enough evidence to hold this guy, you know, for months until – keep him in jail for months until he can put him on trial. The defense doesn't have to do anything. And, in fact, in some ways it's dumb for them to try because they're not going to win that. This isn't, you know, guilt beyond reasonable doubt. This is, can the prosecution pile up enough evidence to make – to establish a reasonable basis to hold the guy? So the defense, they want to keep their cards – play their cards close to the vest. So – you know, they may ask some questions and do a little probing, but they're not going to be putting on witnesses. They're not going to be objecting to a whole bunch of stuff at that point. They're listening to hear what the prosecution has to say.
Well, that makes sense. I think after this, I have a whole bunch of questions I'm going to ask, too, about something else. seriously, I'm learning a lot this week about a lot of things from personal experience, and I go like, oh, my God. How does someone prepare for a murder case like this when he's not a criminal defense lawyer? How does he do that? And he was good. I mean, I would want him to defend me. Nate, he's really good. And he pushed seriously.
I'll tell you, it's hard. I mean, I'm sort of in Nate Daniels' shoes when I was researching this book because I don't do criminal law. I prosecute, you know, big banks and stuff, but I do that civilly, which is a whole different set of rules. And so I had to, you know, go to my friends in the criminal division of the Attorney General's office and talk to them and, you know, get records from cases. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is very different. I mean, if I were ever to try a murder case, I would want to have, you know, a criminal attorney as like a wingman, which is effectively what Nate Daniels, one of the heroes in the book has. You know, he has the public defender, you know, coming alongside and partnering with him and helping him to not make dumb mistakes, which would be easy to make for a civil lawyer in a criminal court.
Well, she's a good character. So you never know when you're going to bring her back or not. But I personally like Brandon.
Well, see how the publisher feels about that.
Well, you know, I don't listen to them too often. My last book, I found a great publisher, and they're fantastic. And when I made a mistake, they fixed it. When they thought I should add something to the book, they fixed it. But they didn't tell me that I couldn't change it. That it's a memoir, so it's different. So what happens right from the start that we know that Brandon is in danger, but yet he could take care of himself? That's kind of a hard situation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, being in jail, that's like a shock to, you know, a lot of people, especially the first time, especially someone like Brandon, who, you know, is not going to know. He's not going to have family members who are in jail and friends who are in jail and can kind of tell him what it's like. You know, he's going from being a college kid to, boom, being in a pretty tough jail. And, you know, given what he's accused of, he isn't with a particularly rough and violent criminal population there. He's not going to understand, like, the social rules in jail. And it's going to be very easy for him to get in trouble with, say, one of the jailhouse gangs, of which there are a number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I know from reading that book about the guy that was in jail. And he said there are a lot of jailhouse gangs. And a lot of times, it's true, the guards just look away. They don't say anything. They just let it happen.
Yeah, I mean, guards, you know, they're... role in the prison is not to make everybody behave well. They're not like kindergarten teachers. They, you know, their role really is to prevent major violence and to prevent major wrongdoing. So, you know, shoving matches, little fights, stuff like that, they'll break it up, but not in a way that's going to put them in danger. Because, you know, sometimes people will have like little scuffles with other prisoners around to lure the guards in. Like they'll set it up just to lure the guards in so they can hurt them. You know, so the guards are going to be careful. And if they just see a couple unarmed guys shoving, they may not intervene right away to break it up.
That's scary. That's real scary. I know my brother was the manager of a bowling center in Yonkers, and I had a league that worked at Rikers Island, a whole bunch of guys that worked at Rikers Island. So I got an education, but one of them was a friend of one of the teachers in my school, and I was the dean, and he said that I was tough enough to work there. I said, no, thank you, it's okay. Yeah. I have that attitude from the South Bronx. So what happens when Hector Garcia attacks him, and what gang does he belong to, and why do they want to take Brandon out?
Well, you know, I don't want to reveal too much of the plot.
No, don't. But, whatever.
but, you know, I'll tell you, when I did the first draft of this, I actually used real gang names. And then ended up changing that before I handed in the manuscript. But there's a gang called Los Reyes, which means the kings. Hector is what's called a shot caller for that gang. And Brandon inadvertently winds up getting in on his wrong side. And Brandon, you know, he is a lot of people are worried like their child going into prison and getting attacked, getting raped, whatever. But you know, Brandon is a tough kid. He's physically tough, physically strong, and he's actually able to take care of himself physically, but emotionally, maybe not so much. The emotional toll it takes on him, you know, and again, I don't want to give away too much, but is much more devastating than the physical toll.
I know, it's like scary. So there's another character that we have, and that's Jade. And who is Jade, and what role does she play, and what happens when they ask her to testify for Brandon? Poor Brandon, didn't have too many advocates here.
Well, you know, and unfortunately, that often is the case in, you know, criminal case where there are really just a small handful of witnesses and they're not all reliable, especially when it's basically a DNA case, in which case it's, you know, the real experts who matter are often the DNA experts. But in this case, Jade is a somewhat ambiguous figure who... She was an escort, and she has very, in her own way, very strong and very intelligent woman who has her own agenda throughout the case that we don't really find out until the end. And so I tried to, you know, have the reader always be having questions about who is Jade, why is she here? Why is she helping? Is she really helping, or is she just setting these guys up?
Well, I didn't trust too many people in this book. And I kept rooting for poor Brandon to knock a few lights, more lights out, because he's so good. So, yeah, but I didn't get to my favorite character, though. Not yet. So we have these girls that they brought in. This is so true, though. I mean, they have these young girls that are brought in, and they're fooled because they think that they're here to work or something, and then they wind up in human sex trafficking, and their parents actually pay for them to come here? I mean, don't they see what's happening?
It really is sad, and this is women. It's not just women, but mostly young women wind up getting trafficked for all sorts of reasons. And unfortunately, in the area where I live, you know, which is where this story takes place in California, it happens a lot.
Oh God!
And you'll hear stories, and it's not just for sex. You know, it's domestic help. There was a story recently in a very nice neighborhood, very close to where I live, where it was discovered, the police discovered an undocumented young woman who was being forced to live in a family's closet as what amounted to a slave. Yeah. And she was the maid, she was the nanny, she was the cook, she did the laundry. You know, she would be working well over 12 hours a day for essentially no pay. And the family kept her a prisoner. She wasn't allowed outside. And that kind of thing happens far too often. Sometimes it's organized criminal groups like we have here. Sometimes it's more like on a one-off basis. But one thing that they will do, and this is more for sex trafficking, is they'll set up what amount to fake modeling agencies in Vietnam, in China, in Thailand. And you get in these young girls, and whose parents may or may not know what's going on. And they promise them, you know, work as models, as dancers, as whatever in America. They bring them over here. They take their passports so that it's impossible for them to flee. And then they turn them into sex workers. And there's, you know, this happens with massage parlors. This happens with dance clubs and strip clubs. Unfortunately, far too often out here. And across the country.
That's what's scary. And then these parents have no way to contact them. So they really don't know how they're doing or what
they're doing. That's right.
I'm learning so many things. Every time I do another book, I learn something else.
Because, of course, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. The people that are doing this are really clever.
Oh, they are. Well, I mean, they take the passports so the girls can't flee. And, of course, they're not going to give them phones. They'll take away their phones if they brought them and then make sure they don't get access to a phone in the U.S. So, you know, usually it's the police finding out about it, like, through customers or through doing undercover work at, like, a massage parlor or something like that.
That's scary. So Jessica does something not too smart. Why does she go and try to question the people herself?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, relatives of people who have been arrested or are criminal parties, you know, are in jail, you want to move the case along faster. You want to help. You want to do something because criminal cases actually move faster than civil cases, but they still go slowly. And so she wants to help. She wants to go talk to witnesses. You know, and here's the thing. Witnesses you can't make a witness testify typically. They have the right not to testify. So Jessica is going and she just desperately wants to get some of these girls to testify to help explain about Link to the court. And they don't want to. And so you're right. She goes and she tries to talk to them, goes into a very rough part of town by herself to try to talk to these girls, and it does not work out well for her. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, you can't tell everybody everything, but I could tell you now that I every time I do a show, I mention this book, and at the end of the show, of course, I'm going to put out the link for the show, and I'm going to post the link for Amazon, and I just have to fix one thing on my review because my eyes were blunking out when I was doing it. But now we're going to get to my favorite character. This is what really, although I love the book to start with, but this is what endeared me to the thing to start with. I have a nephew who is autistic, and Christopher is 7, and he's doing very well. You would not know. So when you introduced Kevin Fang, I was like, this is so cool. So how come you introduced a character like him who's brilliant, who can, you know, know more about DNA, and he's helping, and why did you decide to make him autistic? And my nephew can crunch numbers too, which I thought was really cool.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I actually have an autistic son.
Okay.
And so I know him, of course, I know a number of his friends. And you're right. These are young men and women, mostly men, but who mm-hmm. it's easy when you just talk to them for a brief time to think, oh, there's something wrong, and not realize just how gifted these guys can be, and mm-hmm. how, you know, once you get to know them, you know what sweet young men they are. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to try to make a character who is genuine, like a genuine, realistic character who is autistic, and make him a hero in the story.
I thought that was absolutely brilliant because Christopher, you can't tell at times. You can't tell. He's learned how to focus, and he's really doing well in school. His reading needs a little help. And I told him that his aunt over here, you know, was a reading specialist, but they're doing fantastic work. So I really like Kevin a lot. And I'm glad that people have, you know, that should realize that these kids are smart. So
mm-hmm.
now we've come back to my other favorite character, Nate. I think likes Jessica, but don't tell her. So I got that right away, see? So how did they create the arguments for the trial and then the prosecutor tried to rip them apart, which was not very nice?
Well, prosecutors do that. you know, the what Nate did, again, throughout the story, is try to build the story. It's really easy for lawyers, especially on the defense side, to just try to come up with facts, like, you know, come up like with little bits of evidence and not weave them together into a real story. You wind up with just a pile of facts. And, you know, if one side is telling a story and the other side is just piling up facts, the storyteller always wins. And so this is one of the strands of the novel is Nate working together with the public defender and with Jessica to try to understand what really went on here and be able to come up with the story he can tell the jury.
It's all a matter of how well that story gets, I know, received, too. Trust me, I'm learning that the hard way, too. So they have a DNA expert. This is a really vital question that I have to ask just in general. When you have an expert witness, each side has an expert witness, and each side is paying an expert witness, does the jury know which one is actually telling the truth? And which one is just lying? Because I'm learning that.
Well, and it's usually experts. Neither expert's going to lie. What experts will do is they'll make different assumptions. They'll come at things from different angles. In most cases, like in a private case, experts are often kind of a wash because you're right. The jury knows each side is paying their own experts, and if you put up two reasonably competent experts, they just kind of cancel each other out. In criminal cases, it's different because one side has what amounts to a hired gun in the eyes of the jury, meaning the defense, and the other side, the prosecution, they're putting forward the state employee who works in the lab and, you know, he or she is just there doing their job. They're not getting paid extra to testify. And jurors will often trust the state's DNA evidence more than they'll trust the defense's DNA evidence. And that's one of the things that Nate really has to struggle with at trial is, you know, the state's DNA expert's going to get up there and say there is a match. And Nate somehow got to attack that. and attack it in front of a jury that's used to seeing, you know, the CIS shows and stuff like that, where, you cracked the case through finding the DNA evidence.
I've been watching too many of those. I watch too many of those, I know. So would that be the same in a regular case where it wasn't a criminal case, where if you have an expert in a specific profession, that is better than, like, in the for the plaintiff, that would they listen to them faster than they would listen to the defense if it's a regular case like that?
Yeah, as opposed to, like, the CSI type thing. Typically, you know, it's sometimes you'll get cases where you have, like, a really good expert on one side or the other. But it's rare that you win cases like that with experts. You know, the experts may be able to explain some stuff to a jury, but when you have dueling experts reaching different conclusions, unless one is clearly better than the other, like I said, it tends to be kind of a wash.
Oh, boy. I'm learning something important. So here's Jessica, and she's hiding her feelings for Nate. So why does she want to distance herself? They both want to distance themselves from each other. How come?
Well, there's some backstory there. Nate and Jessica's husband were very good friends, best friends, in fact. And, you know, so Jessica's husband passed away, and she and Nate got very close to each other as a result. But there for, you know, Nate felt guilty about it. Jessica felt guilty about it. Neither one of them was willing to take that next step. And there's also some stuff in Nate's past that if he gets close to Jessica, he's going to have to talk about it. And he really doesn't want to talk about it because it might destroy even their friendship. And again, don't want to get into too many of the plot developments, but, you know, it can be, you know, getting close to someone is dangerous, right? And,
without a doubt.
You know, and especially, you know, as you get older, the dangers, you become more aware of the dangers, and they can get bigger. And, you know, both of them are around 50, a little older. So, you know, they're very aware of the dangers of getting close in a situation like this.
They're not that old. I'm not even going to say anything about that. Oh, so who's in danger and what happens if the truth comes out? I mean, some of those scenes with Brandon were like, whoa, he actually, you know, fought his way through and he got hurt a couple of times. So, I mean, that was amazing. This kid knows. What kind of training did he have that he was able to not get too scared, and he actually took the punches that he got? A couple of times I wanted a punch back.
Yeah, Brandon has been he's an all-state wrestler and does kickboxing too. And this is one thing, you know, living and growing up in the South Bronx, you probably knew some guys who knew how to take a punch. And, you know, people who...
I learned how to give back the punch, too.
Good for you.
and I'm little, too. You have to.
you know, people who have actual experience fighting, even if it's in kind of a controlled setting like, you know, a wrestling match, or a kickboxing ring, you're going to develop instincts. You're going to know how these things work, just like on a nerve level. You know what I mean? So it's just reflex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Brandon has that. And he has more of that than you'd expect of a typical college kid because, right, he was a wrestler and he kickboxes. So when he actually winds up in a situation where it's not in a ring, it's not controlled, it's a life or death situation, he's got that sort of nerve knowledge, those reflexes that allow him to react and protect himself.
He really is good. I mean, growing up where I did, and even where I live now, which is, you know, nice, you still learn to walk with your head. You know, if somebody's walking behind me, I let them go in front of me. If I hear too many, it's horrible. Most of the people where I live don't lock doors, I lock doors. If I see somebody walking into my building behind me and I don't recognize them, I say something. And all, I mean, there was a situation last month where there was this girl in the lobby every single day. And I told the super, I said, what is she doing there? Where is she? And they finally got her in. She was thrown out of her apartment somewhere, so she sat in our lobby. And that's not typical here. She belonged to somebody in the building. So you have to be aware. And that's mm-hmm. what's scary. So somebody like Brandon that's in jail, what should they have warned him about? Or what should they warn somebody that's, you know, can't take care of them? How do you survive?
In jail, you know, it's tough. I've never been in jail myself. You know, I've done some research on it. Know people who talk to people in jail, obviously, you know, with a job and stuff. But, you know, the advice that I keep hearing from, you know, over and over is, you know, keep your head down, try to stay out of trouble. You know, don't let people push you around, but avoid fights whenever you can. And you know, unfortunately for Brandon, he's just not able to avoid fights.
Yeah.
You know, part of it's his personality.
Him.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So, something to fight. Yeah. You don't go looking for fights, but fights come looking for you sometimes. And that's just unavoidable. But you know, part of it is also his personality, and that's, you know, one of the things that he has to work through. I mean, he's changed by being in jail. And, you know, not all the changes are bad. Some of them are pretty rough, but you know,
mm-hmm.
there's some things he needs to learn, a little growing up he needs to do.
I think that some of them become hardened. What scares you sometimes is that, you know, you read a whole bunch of it in the news, and then some of these people get so used to being in jail that when they get out, they want to get back in again, and they don't
mm-hmm.
want to.
Well, and there's some. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You were going to say?
I was going to say, I mean, there are a surprising number of people who don't function well outside of jail.
Yeah.
You know, they can actually behave and lead somewhat constructive lives if they have controls on them, if they're kept away from certain bad influences. If it's, you know, hard for them to get alcohol and drugs. I mean, it's not impossible in prison, but it's harder. You know, so if you have someone kind of keeping an eye on them, watching them, imposing rules on them, they can function. And then they get out, and there aren't those kind of controls, and they get right back in trouble again.
That is like, I know. So this happens in real life, and innocent people that don't have someone like Kevin on their side, what would happen if they didn't, if this was a real case, well, it's real cases like that with DNA, what would happen if they didn't have somebody like Kevin, who's a genius, on the side? You got to bring them back. I don't care what anybody says. I'll tell the publisher myself. We've got to bring them back. I mean, seriously, what happens when somebody doesn't have somebody like him on his side?
Well, it's you wind up convicted and serving your sentence. I mean, there was DNA, you know, I don't want to give people the impression that DNA evidence is regularly used to convict innocent people. It's not. It can happen, especially it could happen under the old FBI rules, as I, you know, mentioned in the afterword to this book.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when DNA evidence first started getting developed and they started going back and testing a lot of these old murder cases, you know, it seemed like every week there's some guy on death row, some poor guy who was exonerated by DNA evidence. You know, wrongful convictions do happen, and it's very sad. And typically, if you don't have, you know, the Kevin Fang on your side, you don't have the Nate Daniels, you don't have the high powered team, you just serve your sentence, even though you didn't do the crime. It's unfortunate.
I reviewed a book last year with about 20 New York Times authors that work for this organization to help people that were wrongly convicted after 20, 25 years and got them out. Philip Mungolin sent it to me. And it was really interesting because you had Lee Child and a whole bunch of authors that actually work for this particular organization to try to help get people out of jail. It was frightening to think that they sat there for so many years. So how did you create the courtroom scenes, and how would you prosecute? How did Nate come up with the opening statement? I mean, really, this was fantastic.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. You know,
oh, I did.
well, thank you. Oh, and one little mention. You talked about Kevin Fang coming back in another story. After
yeah,
I wrote this, I
back.
wrote a Yeah, he has come back. I had a novella that just released. It's actually on sale this week for 99 cents. It's called Secrets, and it does feature Kevin Fang again. It's sort of a prequel to Guilty Blood.
I see that, but now I'm going to have to print it out because I can't read anything that's not in print.
unfortunately, this is only an ebook novella. But you asked about, you know, how I created those courtroom scenes. I was actually wondering, gosh, you know, I've never done a criminal trial. I've done trials, but not a criminal trial.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different. Like I said, now how am I going to do this? I actually wound up getting called for jury duty in a serial murderer case in Oakland.
Oh my God.
In the same courthouse. And I'm like, there's no way any lawyer is ever going to let me sit on a jury, right? I'm a supervising deputy attorney general. You know, any defense lawyer worth his salt is going to keep me off. And they didn't. They picked me. And so I actually wound up sitting in the jury box in a courtroom for 3 days watching criminal opening statements between a good prosecutor and a good defense attorney, listening to the judge, you know, and like just observing. I was like, you know, writing down notes about what the courtroom looked like and how it how they were acting and how it was different from, you know, little ways it was different from a civil trial. It was a lot of fun. It's a very good experience. Unfortunately, we didn't get to go to a verdict because the serial killer defendant actually wound up having a mental breakdown in the middle of trial, so they declared a mistrial. But it was a great research experience.
Can they retry him then?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, they haven't yet. This is a guy who unfortunately has pretty serious mental problems, and you can't try someone if they are not fit to, if they can't assist their counsel.
Gotcha. So,
you know, because it's kind of like
Would he be in a mental institution then?
Yes, he would be in a hospital for the criminally insane, which is like it's a combination jail and hospital.
That's scary. Well, before I forget, Monday, the 29th at 10, New York Times author Matt Coyle will be here with Blood Truth. That's another DNA thing. It's interesting. On the 1st, if you want to read a psychological thriller with a crazy man, that's a bad guy, Head Wounds, Dennis Palumbo. That was really scary. On February 8th, and I'm still looking for someone else to be on the panel, Kate Genovese's son died of an overdose of Percocet, oxycodone, and opiates. Mike Emery wrote a book about the same thing, except his is fictional, and we're going to talk about what happens when too many medications are given out like that. And there's a whole bunch in the news like that right now. On the 13th, I've got The Shepherd's Calculus. And on the 15th, I've got No Fury Like That. It's about a character that gets sent to purgatory and what she learns there while she's there. It's interesting. The Book of Lovers on the 21st. On the 26th, New York Times author Vincent Zandri, The Detonator. And you don't want to be there when that book blows up. It's really scary. And on the 28th, to end the month, I've got New York Times author Brian Freeman, The Voice Inside. He's bringing back Forrest Easton, but he promised me Jonathan Stribe was going to resurface in May. Otherwise, he's going to be in big trouble because I love that book. So what happens when, you know, Brandon is in jail. So what happens when you trust someone that's corrupt and you want to make sure that an innocent person doesn't go to jail? I mean, seriously, what happens when someone you trust is corrupt and you want to make sure that an innocent person doesn't go to jail for life? How do you stop that, or can't you?
You know, it's going to be a case-by-case basis. It's going to be rough. I mean, I actually have a fair amount of faith in the justice system. But it's not perfect, especially if someone has been able to fiddle with evidence, as happened in this book. But, you know, I think, again, I'm not entirely unbiased because of my job, but, you know, I tend to think we usually do get the right people.
Well, I hope so, because I read enough of the news. So how would you define the title Guilty Blood?
It has sort of two meanings to it. One is Brandon, right? He is going to jail because he's got, you know, according to the DNA expert, he's got guilty blood. The DNA in his blood matches the DNA in the blood found under the victim's fingernails. But it's more than that. because one of the things Brandon struggles with is his father died, right? Jessica's husband, his father died in an accident, and Brandon, it was an accident caused by an ex-con who his father had hired. And Brandon, at the beginning of the book, has very negative views about ex-cons, especially you know, ex-cons who are maybe gang members, former gang members. And so he has some very negative, harsh views about them until, you know, by the end of the book, he's coming to realize that, you know, look, yeah, maybe those guys have guilty blood, but, you know, we all have guilty blood, right? I'm not really that different from them.
That is true. But there's one character that we didn't talk about, because we have a few more minutes, is the priest. How did he connect with the priest? Why did he even want to talk to him?
You know, Brandon, he'd grown up in a church family, but he found that, like, his experience in jail was not matching, you know, what he was used to in his nice suburban church. And so he, you know, he had really was questioning his faith, questioning God. And he was not, he didn't feel like he could connect and with like his former pastor and stuff. But you know what, that priest who, and this is, by the way, true, that all, you know, jails will have chaplains, all the Catholic chaplain usually, a Protestant chaplain, and depending on, like, they may have a Muslim or Jewish chaplain too, depending on how large those populations are. You know, and the priest who is the chaplain for this jail, Catholic priest, he's actually a former inmate. And in fact, a former gang member. In fact, Brandon recognizes this guy has some of those same gang tattoos as his enemies in the jail, the guys who've been attacking him. He's like, wow, how can this guy be coming and talking to me? What's with him? And it's that sort of shared experience of being in the jail, knowing the gang culture, that allows that priest to finally be able to get through to Brandon. And in fact, this priest knew some of the people who hurt Brandon, and was able to, and who Brandon hurt, and was able to, like, you know, make that kind of connection that someone who didn't have that shared experience just couldn't.
Well, how come Kevin was in danger too? So they had to send him somewhere with his family. And how did his family feel about him getting involved in this particular case?
Well, you know, hacking is actually illegal. Not everybody realizes that. Especially
in
the
hacker community.
It's
fun to learn how to do it.
Yeah. But, you know, there are rules about hacking. Even if you're hacking for a good purpose, it's like trespassing for a good purpose, right? You know, if you are breaking and entering, you know, whether it's like physically or electronically, you're breaking and entering. You're like, oh, no, I'm just here doing something good. You'll still get arrested. And, you know, it's a lot of hackers also never think they'll get caught. These tend to be young men, confident young men, and they don't realize there are other people out there who are watching and who can trace hackers and who are experts in that. And that causes Kevin some trouble because, you know, again, without giving away too much, he hacks into some government databases, I'll just say. And the government tends to take a very dim view of that. I also say, unfortunately, you know, some of those databases are not super well protected, which is another thing I discussed in the authors afterward, that, you know, there have been massive government hacks, hacks of government databases by other governments that I personally know about because I got my data hacked.
Oh, wow. But, so did I. I know how that feels.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I got mine hacked because, ironically, I was getting a security clearance for something. And so I had to provide all sorts of information to get a security clearance. And I find out that the database that information went into to get me a security clearance, that's the database that got hacked. Right?
That's scary.
You know, yes. And so, you know, and so Kevin doesn't really understand. One of the things I'm sure you've seen with your nephew is the autistic kids and people don't always understand social rules.
Yeah.
It's not like intuitive for them in the same way it is for people who don't have autism. And Kevin has never really fully comprehended why hacking is automatically illegal, even if he's doing something good. But his lawyer and friend, Nate, does understand that. And when Kevin does some very illegal stuff, because he's doing the right thing, so it's okay in his mind, his lawyer realizes, no, it may be sort of morally okay, but it's not legally okay, and you're going to have to go someplace that does not have an extradition treaty with the U.S. Felt about that.
That's scary.
Yeah, and, you know, and it happens. You know, his family is tougher than you might think, just like if you saw them on the street. And, you know, I don't talk about that in the book, but I think that they kind of understand.
Well, growing up where I did, I think the first time I realized that I was in that things were getting bad was when I was walking to meet my friends to go to synagogue on Friday night, and this person came over, a young man, well, not so nice, and so started to say something to me. Now here I am, 12 years old, whatever. This big person is, and I have to tell you, I must have used my street smarts because I may believe I was losing my mind. I started to talk to him in Spanish, Jewish, Hebrew, every language, and he looked at me and I kept saying in Jewish that I was, you know, I'm a shiga or whatever. But he ran away. I was like, oh my! I mean, I never realized that it was getting bad. And I'm saying, the next time I have to go to meet my friends, I'm going to wait till, you know, if it's light outside. Otherwise, I'm not going. I was like, yeah, you got to be brave. I mean, I went to school in a tough school, and I was like, I was lucky my mother was the PTA president and everybody left me alone. But still, you know, you never know. And there were kids that, you know, did things like put thumbtacks on teachers' chairs. And they would do it when I walked in the room, and they'd go, like, you better make it go away because I'm not going to say anything if you make it go away. It's scary. So if Kevin could speak to our listeners, what would he say about his hacking and computer skills? And did he feel he was a vital part of this trial? I love this character. Sorry. So cool.
I think what he'd say about his skills is that this is something he does. It's something that, you know, he enjoys and that he's good at, and that he is just excited he was able to help get a bad guy. That's something he kind of wants to do. And it's almost, you know, a very sort of simple desire. Just like, he wants to go catch a bad guy. Oh, he'd love to do that. And that's part of what he does in this book, and why he is willing to take maybe more chances than he should. But yeah, I mean, this is just something he does, and it's, you know, in some ways he's a very simple character, charmingly simple, I hope.
Well, would they ever hire him from the police department to do work, you know, legally? I mean, I know there are places that actually are there just to hack people. I mean, I got an email the other day from one of my charge cards that somebody had actually used one of my charge cards to do something with Hulu. It was a dollar, but Chase picked it up, and I was lucky. Of course, I had to get rid of the card, which was really annoying. But still, I mean, are there seriously, like, firms that actually are there just to hack into people's?
Oh, yeah. Yes. That there absolutely are. And there are.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's criminal organizations that do nothing but hack. You know, and they go there and they try to get credit card numbers, like it happened to you, personal information. And then when they get enough of that, they can sell it to advertisers. They can sell it to people who will actually run charges on those cards. So in some ways they're like, you know, they're thieves, and they're not actually going to charge your credit card, but they're going to sell your credit card to someone else who will. But they're also white hat hackers. You know, white hats and people who, you know, will work for the government. I mean, the government employs a lot of hackers. So someone like Kevin has very valuable skills, and would, if he wants to use his skills and get paid, he certainly can. You know, it's just going to be a question of finding someone legit who should hire him.
I know that there are classes that people actually take in that cyber hacking or stuff like that. They give them online. I know. It's scary. When I read a book, I like to look up stuff too. I'm learning too many things. So what is next for you? And then Jessica and they can ever get it together? Ouch, my hand.
Well, like I said, what's next for me is I don't have anything under contract now, so I'm kind of a little bit of a free agent. I'm starting to work on a new book
Oh, good.
that may or may not have them in it. And I'll give you just I'll give you just the premise of this book.
Okay.
And that is an FBI agent who works on money laundering is killed. His grieving wife has trouble dealing with it. She's a technology lawyer, and a client of hers offers her. Who do you know what a chatbot is, by the way?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Yeah, she. This
I know
client
too many
creates.
Things. It's terrible.
You can never know too many things, friend.
Yeah, right.
This client creates chatbots for celebrities. It'll draw on, their texts, their Instagram, their emails and stuff to send out like texts and messages that sound like them.
Oh,
and
God.
The client says, I'll do one of these. I'll make one of these for your dead husband. That's going to, it'll be able to draw on all of his emails, all of his texts and stuff like that. And, so it'll sound like him. And, this isn't a permanent thing. This isn't really healthy for you long term, but you're lonely. It'll feel like you're talking to him, using this chatbot. And she's like, "Yeah, it's not healthy, but give it to me anyway." And she starts talking to it, and it does sound like him. And at one point, she asks it, "Tell me something I never knew about you." And the chatbot responds, "I was murdered."
Oh, that's
scary. That's the setup for the story.
Oh, I can't
so,
wait to get
that
before it comes
to
out too. Of course.
Well,
you say yes, it does. I like something that's not usual and normal and whatever. So so before we go, where could everybody find out about all of your other books that I think I read The Whistleblower and this one, and I happened to see you advertise this on Facebook. That's how I knew that it was coming out. I find out everything. You can't stop me, people. And I've got like 50 books inside, and I got this one, and I stuck it on top of my list. I go, no, wait a minute. But I did post a review. I don't know why Amazon hasn't posted it yet. I posted Vindication by Griffin, and it took them 2 weeks to put it on Amazon. I don't know what their problem is. But I did post it, and I did post it on Just Reviews, and I'm going to just fix something because I think I left out the GN Kevin's last name, which is just like me. And I'm going to post the link after the show, too. So where can everybody find out more about you and everything else?
Well, thank you, friend. I have a website, www.rickacker.com, or you can just go to Amazon. My past five books have actually come out through Amazon's publishing arm, APUB. So Amazon has done a very nice job of, making sure all the links on Amazon work and having my bio up to date on Amazon. So that also works at least as well. Just go to Amazon and write in, type in Rick Acker and boom, it pulls it all up.
It did for me just before. I've got it. And I've got it on my phone here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this all on my Facebook wall with all of your books and everything about it. So this way everybody can read it and get it and buy it. And I've got about 10 hands out for your book. They're not getting it. They're going to have to buy it themselves. Sometimes I actually give the – I've got my dentist's office. He gets too much of my money and time. I've got my doctor's offices, and I've got the people in the diner, everyone. And I have people in my building that automatically say, "What do you have for me to read?" They're not getting this one. They're going to have to buy it. No, seriously. And I've got a whole family that doesn't buy books anymore. Because of me. So I want to thank you so much. If I get a chance later, I have a question I have to ask about something. If you know anything about the appellate court, and what happens when the appellate court comes down with something, can you dispute it?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to depend on, you know, what court and stuff. But yeah, when the appellate, when you appeal, like let's say you lose in the trial court and you take something up to the appellate court, and the appellate court then issues a decision, typically you can go to the, you can do one of two things if you don't like their decision.
Mm-hmm.
You can either ask for a rehearing, or you can appeal to the Supreme Court. And that's going to be, there's going to be pretty tight time limits for both of those things.
Yeah, I know.
But, but you can do both of them. And I'll say that, you know, without knowing anything more, those are typically long shots. Once courts have made decisions, they usually don't like to go back and revisit it unless there's really, really good evidence.
Unfortunately, the evidence that was presented, they misunderstood and they didn't listen for the medical evidence and they misinterpreted it because the other side decided to say something and it was wrong. So I said it to my attorneys. I said, maybe if you had paid closer attention to what I was telling you and the people that understand what the problem was, they would know. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you
mm-hmm.
so very much. This is great. I can't wait to read the next one. When do you think it's coming out? Very soon, I hope?
Actually, it's going to be a little while. I was writing at breakneck speed a couple years ago because the publisher had me doing two books per year, and then the novella came out. So I'm just starting on the next one. I'm calling it Ghost in the Machine is the working title.
That sounds great. Are you going to come to the Thriller Fest, or don't you come to that?
You know, I haven't in the past. I almost came last year, and I was going to be on a panel with them, but I had to pull out at the last minute. I may actually be coming this summer. I would love to come to that.
You have to tell me because they invite me every year. Kimberly Howe Loves Me, the girl that runs it. I just finished her latest book, Skyjacked. Oh, my God, was that fantastic. And, of course, Guilty Blood is fantastic, and all the books I've been getting are really unbelievable. And, yeah, I get invited. And the only thing I have to worry about is the room at the Grand Hyatt. Other than that, I get to go to all the classes and enjoy to meet everybody, which is fantastic. So if you're coming, that would be fantastic too.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I will definitely let you know if I'm going to be there. It would be wonderful to finally meet you in person, Fran.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Rick. Everybody have a great day. I can't believe it. The sun is shining, but it's 20 degrees in New York. And, 22 actually. It's warm. Have a great day, Rick. Thank you so much, and bye.
Thank you, friend. All right, bye-bye.